And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, it is December 22nd, 2013. Christmas is only a few days away, and we need to remember what the season is about. Denise, are you with us tonight? Okay, hopefully Denise will be joining us shortly, and we've invited her to come in. As Christmas rolls around, I think it's important to think about it and think back in history and remember some of the great things we've had with Christmases. So please think about all your great Christmases, what you saw, what you had, what you did all the years. And remember, what Christmas is all about is about giving and, you know, doing some, making a contribution to make it better. Again, that's what Gary Noel and Progressive Radio Network and all of us are about, helping and giving and teaching and exciting and getting people going to do things. So it's all real, real important. Well, for me, Christmas, I mean, there's so many years. I've been around a few years. One of the Christmases that I remember, it was a real special Christmas, is back in about 1957 or 58. I got one of these fire trucks that actually squirted water. You probably remember that. That's famous from Miracle on 34th Street, where the young boy asked for that same fire truck. Well, I did get one back at that time, too. So it was really enjoyable and everything else. Christmas, 1967. Well, I just enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, and I was on active duty for basic training down at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. And we did get to see a Christmas show and everything else, and it was pretty neat. Very, very interesting. And then Christmas in 1968, I ended up in Lowry Air Force Base and enjoying a lot of time out there and getting to learn and see and do everything in the bomb nap field. And then Christmas of 69, we're at Utapau. Christmas of 70, we're at Utapau. Christmas of 1971, I'm back in college again. And then come along Christmas of 1990, we're over in Desert Storm with a whole bunch of us. Denise, are you here by chance? Okay, hopefully she'll call in. I talked to her earlier. I know she's very, very busy. You know, one thing I'd like to do tonight, just come back in a little bit of history and look at it and everything. What is Christmas really all about? And I think I'd like to start off the show with actually reading the very first thing, the Christmas story, Luke 2, 1 through 20. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to his own town to register. So Joseph also went up to the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem to the town of David, because he belonged to the house of David, line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger, because there was no room for him in the inn. And there were shepherds living out in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord of glory shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news, a great joy that will be for all the people. Today in the town of David a Savior is born to you. He is Christ the Lord. This will be a sign to you. He will find the baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." Suddenly, a great company of heavenly hosts appeared with the angel praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest on earth, peace to men of whom his favor rests." And when the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about." So they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and the baby who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told to them about this child. And all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned glorifying and praising God for all things they had just heard and seen, which were just as been told. Well, that's what it's about, ladies and gentlemen. Whether you're in the military or civilian, when you're out there in combat, whether you're returning from combat, we all have that. Denise, are you with us by chance? Okay. Well, we'll continue on with another Christmas story. If anybody wants to call in and share Christmas memories, please do at 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. Well, in Christmas of 1970, I was back over to Utapau Air Force Base, Thailand, and we were flying, it was BombNav Hardhat flying combat missions, maintaining the systems and flying missions on B-52s. And this was a story that I wrote a few years ago about this, and just an emotional time for me, and anybody that's in combat will understand this. Christmas 1970, a time without peace. As our nation celebrates Christmas once more with Americans harm's way, my thoughts return to an experience so long ago in a distant land during a previous war. Although a Christmas truce had been announced formally and the Americans at home, then referred to as the world, thought there would be a cessation in bombing and fighting throughout Southeast Asia, reality was quite different for those of us with combat missions complete. December 24, 1970 arrived with a warm tropical sun dispelling any dreams of a white Christmas. While I knew that the celebration of the birth of God's son Jesus was just hours away as I prepared for the evening's combat mission, my thoughts turned to the blessings of God and how I could have resolved the moral dilemma of engaging in combat on this most holy day, Christmas, most holy day. Christmas Eve arrived with the sound of aircraft flying overhead and a candlelight church service in the base chapel. As I had done during my childhood, I went to the service to sing songs of praise and joy in anticipation of Jesus' birth. I left the candlelight service refreshed and praying for peace amongst all nations, especially in our small, war-torn corner of the world. A Huey helicopter hovered above dispensing snowflakes as I left the chapel in what seemed an unusual prelude to a night when B-52s would rain bombs and death upon the enemy far below. Our mission was not unusual, except we were going into combat on Christmas Eve with a conclusion, death on Christmas Day. We put a reel of Christmas music on the woolen sack type recorder and sang Christmas songs as we flew towards our IP and fate with destiny on our Lord's birthday. We interrupted Silent Night to switch reels as required to record radio transmissions during our bombing mission. We dropped our bombs with knowledge that it was Christmas morning and replaced the mission reel with the Christmas music reel and resumed our rendition of Silent Night. The irony of this event did not escape any of us, and we soon were discussing the meaning of killing, even in war, on Christ's birthday. We were not dealing well with the significance of these contrasting events when suddenly the sky was bright as day, and the voice of our Lord echoed in our minds, "Be at peace, for today is Christmas, and you just did your job." Today, as we gaze in combat once more on Christmas Day, we must remember that message is one of the peace among all nations and peoples of the earth. We must set aside economic, political, and social agendas and strive for peace and harmony. That was a promise issued so long ago. I pray that understanding will prevail and revenge will be set aside with the dedication to restoring the brotherhood of all peoples on earth. We cannot use only force to settle disputes, but must strive in our actions and our thoughts for peace on earth. To quote one hymn, "Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me." Christmas 1970. I think everyone that's been in combat has thought about it. Everybody that's had any time away from their folks and families on Thanksgiving Day or any holiday, or especially Christmas, it's something to think about. Denise, are you here by chance?
Yes, I am. Sorry, I was a few minutes late catching up with you tonight.
You're pretty busy, aren't you?
Well, it's called Decide to Do Projects Before Christmas, and hustling to finish them and pick up my daughter this evening.
Your daughter flies in tonight from Washington, D.C., where she's in law school, correct?
That's correct.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
We're halfway through. It's 3 years, so that's 6 semesters, and she's 3 semesters done.
Who'd have thought when she was just a young kid when we all started working together and you had all the dreams and hopes, and now she's achieving them. Wow.
Yeah, it's exciting. But, yeah, we were redoing her room to some degree, so it was a hustle, hustle, hustle. You should not do major things before Christmas.
You're real close to the airport, aren't you?
It's a little further than it used to be. When it was at Stapleton, it was like 15 minutes. Now it's more like 30, 40. Because, you know, they built the big new airport for Denver way out to the northeast of town.
Well, you know, I never asked you. Were you and I both there in Denver in Christmas of 1968? I was at Lowry.
In 68, no. I was in Texas. So,
you're a Texas girl, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I was born, raised, went to school there, and then joined the military there, and it was hard to get out there. I guess the military wanted to keep their Texas girls in the state. I don't know.
Well, what kind of memories do you have all of Christmases past? I shared a little bit while I was waiting for you to join us.
Yeah. Well, being that I was never overseas during a holiday period, that I worked Wilford Hall. And so a lot of times, you know, people that live, you know, out of state, we kind of let them have leave and the rest of us handled the Christmas time. But Christmas in ICU, surgical ICU in Wilford Hall years and years ago. So, and, you know, it's hard to be in the hospital during Christmas. It's hard for things to happen during Christmas. We just had another school shooting here in Denver, and the shooter, you know, eventually killed himself, but he shot one girl, and she died yesterday. She was shot in the head, and I didn't think it bode well. It wasn't a miracle like Congressman Gibby. Gafford had, but she died yesterday. So my heart and hopes and sorrow goes out to the families that lose somebody at Christmas. And we also had servicemen injured overseas just yesterday, I think. They were going in to get the Americans out of Sudan. That's turning very violent. So we had 8 injured service personnel injured. Haven't heard their status as of yet, but our forces are still in harm's way, and hopefully every American will spend a few minutes in prayers and thoughts about a service person being overseas, away from their families, in harm's way. We have forces in Afghanistan. We have forces in a lot of places that people aren't aware of that are dangerous. And we need to remember their sacrifices, their family sacrifices during this time.
It's important to pray for them. I can remember in all the years that I was overseas getting the Christmas care packages from family and friends and sharing them with everybody I knew. It was very, very important.
And not only that, but we have, you know, veterans that are ill and either in hospitals or home or nursing homes or hospice situations, and it's a very hard time for veterans. If you're suffering PTSD, if you're suffering the Guffor illness or whatever they decide to name it, it's very hard. I know that I struggle trying to do the little bit I'm doing, you know, at home, much less try to do any Christmas shopping. We had to go look for a bed, and we had done that. And coming back across town, my husband said, well, let's stop in the shopping center. And I tried valiantly, you know, to do that. And I didn't get very far. And I said, you got to take me home. And it's very depressing. You know, you just can't do as much that you'd like to do. Those that are suffering PTSD feel they have a feeling of disconnection and kind of a empty feeling. And it's very hard for them. I've read a lot on Facebook in the last day or two when I've had a few minutes. And there's a lot of them that have an empty feeling that try to put on a good face for their children. And it's really, really a hard time of year. And once we get through Christmas going into New Year's, that's when I get on high alert, because people may make it through Christmas and then decide they don't want to go any further and find ways to end their lives.
That's one of the most difficult things. I think another thing, too, I mean, our weather here, I don't know about you out there in Denver, because you're a few days ahead of us, but we've had blasts of winter weather after blasts of winter weather, and it's very, I mean, weird. We go from warm to cold to ice to rain, the snow, and everything else. So, I mean, with all of the medical problems that all the veterans have, whether they're, you know, the Vietnam era vets, we're not young anymore. Most of us in our 60s or some into the 70s are in Vietnam. I know we just lost a couple of Vietnam vets here recently. One worked at the Corps of Engineers Army that I knew for a long time, and another Vietnam vet. We have to be very, very careful on shoveling snow on labor, don't we?
Yeah, we really do. You know, people, you just don't, you know, comprehend. Right now, it's time for families to gather. and, you know, those that are in good health. And it's not just the veterans that are ill, the civilians that are struggling with, you know, cancers or, you know, the chronic fatigue that the civilians also have. It's very, very hard time of year. Everybody's, you know, happy and families are gathering. And a lot of times our veterans, if they don't have a family, are, you know, civilians that are chronically ill for whatever reason, end up very isolated. Not only do they try to put on a good face when they're around their family, but there's an emptiness they feel. Doug, I don't know if you ever felt that. You've gone to Vietnam and the Gulf War. Was there any feelings that you have of emptiness or, you know, dread of the holidays?
Yes and no. I mean, I was real fortunate because the groups I was with, you know, we had a very tight-knit group all from Vietnam all the way through. But, yeah, that emptiness is there. I mean, for us on our, you know, Bowers Raiders, you know, what's left of us now, we still all do get, you know, try to get together over Christmas and talk. And, you know, you become so close to people. I mean, you might not see everybody every day. Well, in my case, Rilo and I see each other all the time. But other ones of us were so incredibly close to each other, and we've gone through so many experiences. I mean, I remember, and this is really, really strange, but I met Johnny Bench at, during a Bob Hope show back in 1970, and then I met Johnny Bench again at the Bob Hope show at Escan Village in 1990. I mean, it was like, what is weirder than this? You know, but the emptiness of not feeling there, and again, the same thing at the end of the Bob Hope show, which is legendary, you know, singing Silent Night, and the emotions that just go over through your body. I mean, there's no way to describe it to this day. I mean, Silent Night for me, because of the connections, is an overwhelming physiological and mental experience.
So what kind of advice can we give the family members that have veterans or people that are chronically ill? What can we say to them to help them to understand and reach out, particularly at Christmas?
Well, I think one thing's real important, and again, this comes under the problem we've ran into, and I've had to do this. We've had so much snow and ice here that we've had to, you know, we get stuck, we have to go out there and dig ourselves out. And you have to be so very, very careful. I mean, it's extremely important. Yes, there might not be anybody to help you. Hopefully you can get somebody else to help you. But if there isn't and you have to go out and shovel snow or you have to dig yourself out or rock your car back and forth to get out of an icy patch or a snow patch, you got to take it in moderation. Be very, very careful. I mean, myself the other day, I mean, three of us got stuck within a few minutes. Actually, four of us got stuck pretty much in the same spot within a few minutes. And we just had to take time and share it, and we couldn't work continuously on our own. We had to sit down in the car and warm up again. It's so easy to get overworked on this stuff. And the other thing, too, again, I mean, Denise, you live at a higher, you're higher altitude. You're higher up in Denver yet,
oh, yeah,
aren't you?
And I feel it. I feel better when I get to the coast and I'm at lower altitude. It's amazing. I do feel better with a change of altitude.
And I know, because your perfusion is messed up just like mine is.
Yeah, and so, you know, a lot of vets, I think, have moved out of Colorado because of the altitude. It makes it difficult. And what makes it really difficult is veterans particularly, they hesitate to ask for help. They really do.
John Wayne and Rambo all put together, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, they just feel like they have to get out and do it themselves and don't think to reach out and say, well, does it really have to be done, number one? Number two, you know, can I get a neighbor to help or call somebody, you know, to help? Whether it's the fire department, if they're not busy, say, hey, I'm a veteran, I can hardly do this, can you come help? Whether it's clear a driveway of snow or, you know, a walkway, you know, our services that we have, a lot of times if they're not on a call or if it's not busy, you can call them and ask. All they can say is no, right?
Yeah, try your American Legion, VFW, DAV, AMVETS, whatever you have in your area.
The hard thing is when you look at the fellow service organizations, they're older too, you know. So it's kind of like, do you have a son or a daughter that's home that can help, or, you know, that kind of thing. There's really, you know, I think there's a need in every community, not only for veterans that are ill or people that are ill, but the elderly, to have a system and some volunteer network that you can really call on. And I know it's even harder in rural areas, although our rural areas are, they develop their friendships and they're awfully close, you know.
Yeah, we don't have any problem. I mean, we, you know, everybody helps out, everybody out here, and we'll dig out, you know, get the tractor and plow it out or help you, but you still have to be careful. I mean, I go back to my winter operations time, and you spend a lot of time in where you live in the cold weather and up in the mountains. And proper clothing and proper nutrition is absolutely critical at this time of the year, isn't it?
It certainly is. And people, you know, may want to go out and see nature, and then they get stuck. And we just had, you know, the couple and their children that were rescued, and they were pretty inventive. I mean, their vehicle turned over. They stayed in it, and they took the extra tire, I guess, and got stones and rocks and built a fire. And then they brought this hot stones into the car to warm up the car. And some of the things they did just out of, you know, inventiveness at the time saved their lives. Doctors and medical people were expecting frostbite problems and everything. And I guess they were in the hospital maybe 48 hours and were released. So you've got to have your head about you. And, you know, always have some extra supplies in your car if you're traveling, you know, in areas that could, you know, have problems like snow and freezing weather. Think ahead. And I know our military is always inventive, especially if they've been to war. You become very inventive to get things done in wartime. And so I don't worry so much about them as I worry about civilians that have never had survival training or anything to that degree.
You know, but even in the military, and I found this, we try to, you know, play John Wayne and Rambo. And out here in the rural areas of Illinois, if you get a lot of snow and it's cold and it's 10 degrees out and you've got a wind chill of minus 5, your body's going to cool down to that 10 degrees rapidly with the wind chill. So even unless you're dressed properly, you're not going to make it very well. So, I mean, we have to put some, again, what I want to do, and this is a story I came from, the ones that got stranded out there in Colorado and got overturned. You got to be careful where you're going and what you're doing. I mean, unless you really need to go out on the trip or travel someplace when the weather's bad, ladies and gentlemen, you just shouldn't do it. It's so easy to get hypothermia set in. I mean, we've had in winter operations hypothermia set in so fast and so swiftly and so much danger that you don't know what's hitting you. It's very, very dangerous. And again, the same thing is proper nutrition. I mean, a lot of protein, a lot of, you know, carbohydrates and everything, maintain your body's ability to generate heat and keep going at the same time. And at the same time, you know, forget the alcohol and forget the nicotine. That does not do any good, does it?
No. And, you know, I want to take a few minutes. I don't know if we're transitioning, but David Wynette, our very wonderful Marine.
Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. He wrote a new poem and put it up today, and it's for our Persian Gulf War warriors.
Can you read this for us, please?
I sure will. Persian Gulf warriors left for dead. For two decades and more, their government continually said, this illness is all in their heads. The veterans who served were not being heard, their lives, their livelihoods, their families as well. Their greatest dreams were literally going to hell. Unbearable pain from toe to head. Profound fatigue, their legs feeling like lead. Eventually, these veterans began to understand. They've been abandoned and left for dead. Beyond the pain and misery their illness brought to every waking hour, by far the most pain derived was coming to grips with the emotional hurt inside. To have lived and believed in the warrior creed that no one is left behind. When the warrior finally understands the emptiness that's hidden behind often quoted slogans meant to entice new recruits, simplify, the few and the proud, an army of one, and no one left behind. When the truth emerges, when they're finished and have no further use for you, it's out the gate you go. We wish you the best. You pass the test, a farewell and a hearty goodbye. But woe is a warrior who later dares connect unusual illnesses to wartime exposures. All manner of toxins, chemicals, and biological weaponry, medicines unapproved for human use and more. How dare that warrior complain too loud? Why doesn't the warrior follow procedure? Suck up the pain and die obediently proud. Act like a warrior, be loyal and true. Deal with your pain, your government is truly counting on you. Don't give up hope, but above all else, don't you dare rock the boat. It's all in your head, your imagination gone wild. We've seen this before. Be a good little warrior. Accept the consequences of going to war. Whatever you do, never believe what they said, that your government doesn't care, that we've left you for dead. We'll always be there to you till the end. We'll always be true. Just follow procedure. Don't call us. We'll call you. That is some, I think it reflects many of us reflecting on what we went through, Doug. And it goes for Vietnam vets, too, that had exposures to Agent Orange and to the atomic vets, which are probably very few alive now. And, you know, Christmas and New Year's is, you know, time for family and reflecting. And I think this reflection is some of the unfinished business that our government has that it hasn't moved forward on. And I think my wish and my hope would be to be able to present a gift to all of us, Gulf War veterans, that we could make a difference. And we're struggling to do that. Our research advisory committee that has been the brightest light we've had for years is being snuffed out, basically, by the VA secretary. I think everybody should take a few minutes, send them a Christmas card, and say, you're doing wrong by the Gulf War vets. And on that Christmas card, I don't care if it gets there late. If we could get 10,000... 20,000 Christmas cards to Secretary Shinseki saying there's many Gulf War veterans that are hurting and not getting help and feeling forgotten. And this is the time of year that suicides do go up during holidays. We know that. I've been through it, you know, when I was nursing. You have more problems with alcohol and bleeding ulcers happening. You know, it's unfinished business that's 23 years. And they're gutting our research advisory committee, taking hope away. I know Anthony Hardy, myself, Marguerite Knox, those that served on the committee, and those that, like myself, that were there to be witness and to do public comment, not for myself, but for all. We're feeling really, it's been a very hard year seeing this happen and continuing to battle. And this show got started over the Gulf War illness, Doug. So I always bring that up no matter what we're talking about, whether it's an author we're talking to, trying to struggle to find some way to help veterans. And I think it's going to take an uproar from civilians. The vets are struggling that went to the Gulf War. There's no rhyme or reason sometime of who gets their claim through, who doesn't. There's no known treatment for this. We had hopes through the Research Advisory Committee. We had a good group of dedicated scientists that were doing the review independently, not just the VA research, but any research. And now they're going to concentrate on just VA research. And our VA research has not really gained our confidence, have they, Doug?
They haven't. I mean, one of the problems you run into when I see this day after day is talking to the doctors and nurses that are providing care. They don't have the information. They don't have the time to go looking for it. They don't understand what's happened. And as a consequence, they can't understand how do they optimize the medical care that they provide for so many that are hurting so much. I mean, the Vietnam vet, I mean, I keep running into more and more with Agent Orange. Yesterday I ran into the son of an atomic war vet, and he had just got his dad's service records and found out his dad had been out there at the flats in 1948 and 49, never knew it.
Yeah.
You know, so it is, I mean, it's that whole dream and that whole hope that Christmas, that somehow one day we would get a Christmas present and all the vets would be somehow miraculously all taken care of without any more debate, any more discussion. You know, a Christmas present, that would be wonderful.
Our law that got us the Research Advisory Committee came at the end of the year, and it was at Christmas. And I was so happy when we had gotten that through and I got word that, you know, it had passed. And it took a couple of years after that to actually get a meeting because there had been another law, and they sent it to the Justice Department to decide if there was a conflict between the laws. So that held us up for quite a while when you send it over to the Justice Department. So, you know, I always try to think, you know, what is coming, what new research can give us hope. And we've had some hope this year from Dr. Haley, from Dr. Veronica up at Georgetown, the studies that are going on. And I just feel like a wrong turn has been made by our secretary. And, you know, you always want to believe in the people that are put in the positions. But when they do something like this, that the majority of the Gulf War vets do not feel this is the right thing, but yet the secretary is pushing ahead. When we go on January 7th and 8th, this is the next RAC meeting, there's going to be many changes. And I don't think they're going to be dynamic changes that we'll all welcome. From the info I have, which is sketchy at best right now, but the info I'm getting is this is not what we wanted, and it continues not to be what we wanted. And so it's been a hard year, and then to be facing Christmas, and, yeah, each Christmas, you know, it seemed like we had a little ray of hope, and I'm really struggling to find that ray of hope to spread to others. We still have got researchers that are putting in proposals to the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. We had Brent Casey serve as a medical reviewer. Now, people don't know, but Brent Casey is the grandson of one of our Medal of Honor recipients.
He's also the official photographer for the Medal of Honor Society right now.
Right, exactly. So I have a lot of faith that he did a good job. I know another one that I feel very positive about. I mean, he's one that's had hypercoagulation and a pulmonary embolus. So, you know, he's aware of problems firsthand. And so we don't know and probably won't know for a good while what gets approved through that process for the funding we got. So, but the problem is our Research Advisory Committee was supposed to be an independent committee, not ruled by the Secretary of the VA. Whether he liked their reports or not, these were independent reports. Not behooving to what they were told to do, but doing the job as they should, independently reviewing the research. And no, I guess no one could ever be perfect, but I think we had a good group of working researchers and scientists that had the knowledge and skills we needed. And I can't think of others that would be brought in, that I would yell and scream and jump up on the table and dance if I had the energy. So, you know, we have a continual problem for the Gulf War vets, and like I said, there's no rhyme or reason. We have one of our chaplains, I think she was Army, over in Michigan. She's a service officer. She's out of training. She puts in her claim. It comes back denied. And I asked her about how the statistics for over in Michigan. Being a service officer, she would know. She goes, it's the worst state for a Gulf War vet to live in.
What state? What state is worse?
Michigan.
Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
And that's frightening, too, because of all the great reports that came out of Michigan.
Yeah.
The senatorial group.
Yeah. So, you know, we have to get creative, and, you know, we need our vets standing up, their families, their extended families. We need, you know, if they have kids in school, we need to get the parents and teachers involved. I mean, we need to be flooding these elected people on the needs of the veterans. And the budget bill they just put through, I don't think it's very encouraging to try to recruit people into the military when you're going to cut their, you know, pensions like they did in order to balance the budget. I think the veterans in the military already carry the heavy load on their back that civilians don't.
Well, I think one of the things people understand, I mean, even if you have 100% disability, that is not very much income.
No.
It is very low. I mean, the amount of money that you're getting is very low in comparison to what your life, your expenses are.
Then when you start cutting retirement pay and limiting COLAs in the future to below the normal, you know, how does that encourage people to go and serve the military for a career? Are we going back to the draft? Maybe we need to wake up people of, you know, what the military does for them. Maybe we do need to go back that route.
Well, I think, I mean, for me, it's most frustrating, especially at Christmas with the total abandonment, and you get all the phone calls and the requests for help and the simple needs that are seem to be unmet. I know, it's frightening. I mean, I'm not even sure where to begin to hope.
And I don't know. How many civilians even think of their military during Christmas time? You know,
people will put a care Christmas package together, a care package, and they'll run on down to the post office and they throw it in the mail and they think it's all over.
Yeah.
That's irrelevant almost in comparison to the need that's out there.
That's true. And, you know, I think it was World War One. I don't know if you mentioned that, but the, you know, unintended ceasefire that occurred.
Oh, you mean, yeah, when they rang their Christmas bells.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the legendary stories. All of a sudden, the bells started ringing, and even on both sides, they were still singing Silent Night together.
And they came out and shook hands. And then the next day, they're back at war.
Yeah, but then, you know, again, we're looking at the times and the pieces where, you know, you still had families that were fighting on both sides of the conflict.
That's what's different now, is with World War One, World War Two, it involved everybody. Everybody made a sacrifice. And we move into Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf Wars. It's not an even distribution of who is serving and who is carrying that weight. And that's why I almost think, yeah, we need to go back to the draft. You know, we wanted a professional army, and we got away from the draft. And we've done that, but the connection with the civilian world has been broken.
You know, talking about this connection with the civilian world, I picked this up just a little while ago. John Eisenhower, Ike's son, who was an historian and an army general in himself, just died. He was 91 years old. So that's another total link that's disappearing.
Yeah, there's getting to be fewer and fewer of the World War II vets alive.
Yeah. Yeah, he was born in 1922, so he graduated from West Point on D-Day 1944, according to the story. Very interesting.
And then we think of the others that were forgotten. And I feel like the Gulf War vets are now the new forgotten, but the Korean War vets. And they're still there. A lot of them served World War II and Korea.
They absolutely did. I mean, I knew people that served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And then we had Korea, Vietnam, you know, tied
Gulf
together.
War.
Then a whole bunch of us served in Vietnam and went back to Desert Storm, and there's even a handful that went on to the current wars. Staggering.
So, you know, my wish and my hope is for VA to really have an attitude change. Many years ago, they hired Disney to come and do customer service training. I don't know if that money was wasted. I feel like probably it was. I think they spent about $1 million bringing in Disney people to do customer service training.
Wow.
Yeah.
That comes back to the same thing. I keep asking the question, why do you have to have a patient advocate if you're doing everything right? And why do you have to have an inspector general if you're doing everything right? There shouldn't be any of these questions. There shouldn't be any of these problems. I mean, speaking to my local congressman, two of them, we've got two congressmen in our area, and I've been fortunate enough to work closely with both of them. And day in and day out, they're putting out fires at the VA, whether it's in Indianapolis or here in Danville or up at Chicago, they're putting out the same fires. And yet the problems don't seem to be resolved because it's the same fire that erupts for the different veterans. And it should be like, okay, we have one problem, we solved the problem, and now we don't see that again. It goes on, but we don't. That's not what's happened. I mean, that's what David Wynette is writing about, isn't it?
Yes, it's exactly. And I had to read it. I haven't had much time to be on Facebook the last couple of days, and I saw that, and I said, we need to read that point because it reflects how all the living Gulf War vets that are left, and we don't get data now from the VA to know how many are living even.
We don't know. We were with the Griffiths reports. We were at least getting the information who'd applied for disability, what percentage they were getting. But all that disappeared, and then the reports that Paul Sullivan was digging up all the time on OAF, OEF, I haven't seen one of those in a long time either with the diagnostics ICD-9 codes.
No, it's been over a year and a half, maybe 2 years, because they split the data, and they called it the pre- and post 9/11, and that's the only thing we have to go by now. There's been nothing new out in the last 2 years.
We talk about a lot. I'd like to read something else here. This is a very nice story, and you can chime in a little bit about it. You probably remember The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. It's a beautiful story, and again, hopes and dreams and, you know, what it's all about. $1.87, that was all, and 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with a silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. Three times Della counted it, $1.87, and the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on a shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it, which instigates a moral reflection that life's made up of sobs and sniffles and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home, a furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beg your description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for a mediancy squad. In the vestibule below was a one-letter box which no one would go, an electric button from which no mortal finger chose to ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name, Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during the former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 a week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, though, they were thinking seriously of contracting a modest and unassuming D. But whatever, Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above what he called Jim, and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, Aretha introduces Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended her cheeks with the powder rape. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she only had $1.87, which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months with the same result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses have been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Many a happy hour she has spent planning for something nice for him, something fine and rare and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin, a very agile person may, by observing the reflection in rapid sequence, of longitudinal strips obtained a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly, she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, and her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly, she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there were two possessions of James Dillingham Young's in which they both took mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch. It had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the airship, Della would have let her hair hang out the window someday to just let dry out, to depreciate her majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed to see him pluck his beard from the snow. So now Della, beautiful hair, fell about her rippling, shiny like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again, nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, on went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with a brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and downstairs the street, where she stopped. The sign read, Matasopony, hair goods of all kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madam, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofrini. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della. I buy hair, said Madam. Take your hat off and let's have a sight at looks of it. Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madam, lifting the mask with the practiced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della. Oh, in the next 2 hours, trip by on rosy wings. Forget the hash metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in the days of store. She had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not meticulous ornamentation. As all good things should be, it was worthy a task of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that, the chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way to a little prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by the generosity of added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her hair was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at the reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically. If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a look and second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door where he entered. Then she heard a step on the stair right away on the first floor, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying a little prayer about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I'm still pretty." The door opened and Jim stepped in, closed it. He looked thin, very serious, poor fellow. He was only 22 and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat and was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della. There was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly, with that particular expression on his face. Della wiggled off the table and went for him. Jim, darling, she cried. Don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold because I couldn't have lived without Christmas giving you a present. It'll grow out again. You won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say, Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a nice and what a beautiful nice gift I've got for you. You've cut off your hair? Asked Jim laboriously, as if it had not arrived at the patent fact yet, even at the hardest mental labor. Cut it off and sold it, Della, said Della. Don't you like me just as well, anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I? Jim looked around the room curiously. "You say his hair is gone?" he said with air of idiocy. "You needn't look for it," said Dell. "It's sold, I tell you. Sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve. Boy, be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered," and she went on the sudden serious sweetness, "but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim?" Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to awake. He unfolded his Della for 10 seconds, let us regard the discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year. What's the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you this wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not amongst them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it on the table. "Don't make a mistake," Deli said, "about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that can make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap the package, you'll see why you had me going for a while at first." White fingers nimble tore at the string of the paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy. Alas, a quick, feminine chain of hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the flat. For there lay the combs, a set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful comb, pure tortoiseshell, and jewel rims just to the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession, and now they were hers. But the tresses she should have adorned had covered adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look them dim eyes and said, smile and say, "My hair grows fast, so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped like a little girl and cried, oh. Jim had not seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with the reflection of her bright, ardent spirit. "Isn't it dandy, Jim? I hunt it all over town. You have to look at it 100 times a day. Now give me your watch. I want to see how it looks." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Dell," he said, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep them for a while. They're too nice to use just as a present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now you surprise me. Now you suppose we put the chops on?" The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents, being wise. Their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in the last word to the wise of these days, let it be said to all who give gifts, these two were the wisest of all. Oh, all who give and receive gifts, such as they were the wisest. Every one, they are the wisest. They are the Magi. That story is kind of touching, isn't it?
It's very touching. And what we need to do is find a way, everybody in your own hometown, your own street, find out who has served in the military, who's a veteran, and go by and have a cup of coffee. Bring them some donuts. Let them know that they're not alone. So many of them are older now, maybe in nursing homes or hospice, or maybe living alone. And the gift is love. And it's love thy neighbor and care for them. And I bring in the veterans and the service members, as we should, as everyone should, and find a way to remember them, to let them know that they are not alone. And yes, Christmases are very, very hard on our service members and on our veterans, because if they've been in battle, even if they haven't been raided, they probably have some PTSD, and they're fighting that numbness and that feeling of emptiness. So find a way to reach out and make a difference.
What are you doing for Christmas? Your daughter's flying in a few minutes, right?
Yeah. She'll land around 8 o'clock. So it's about 6 o'clock. We've got about 6 minutes left in the program. I want to wish all the people that are traveling safe travels, and to gather together in love and remember what Christmas is about. It's about love and so many gifts that we have. The gift to the veterans is, yes, they came home. And they may be wondering why. They may have feelings of guilt if they lost friends and buddies in a war. And my goodness, Christmas is hard. Those memories from childhood, from the times you served and you weren't able to get home, to the horrendous memories. They all seem to flood back during this time.
It's well, you not, know, there's one thing, and I get that song from World War II, I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Right.
Well, the time has run out, ladies and gentlemen. We wish you a Merry Christmas. Denise, my love, and Merry Christmas to you and John.
And to all of us that's out there, love and Merry Christmas to each and every one of you and your family members.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, Merry Christmas, and have a good time. Enjoy the holidays, and remember to take care of each other. Thank you very much. God bless. Denise, have a Merry Christmas. Enjoy your family.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.